Hello and welcome to BioBytes, brought to you by the Rockefeller University Press. My name's Ben Short, and coming up in this show, we'll hear how a microtubule binding protein controls the size of meiotic spindles, and we'll hear about a protein kinase that controls the size of nuclei during development. And of course, we'll also size up the rest of this month's highlights from the Journal of Cell Biology. First up, we hear from Caitlin Sedwick, who investigates why the size of the meiotic spindle varies in different frog species.
All eukaryotic cells have a microtubule-based spindle apparatus that shepherds chromosomes through the process of cell division. But spindles from different species can look quite different, even when those species are closely related. For example, Rebecca Heald's lab at the University of California, Berkeley, showed that spindles that form in meiotic egg extracts from the large frog Xenopus laevis are themselves quite large, about 35 micrometers from end to end. By contrast, a smaller frog, Xenopus tropicalis, has much smaller spindles. This striking result attracted the notice of Dr. Kara Helmke when she was a graduate student in Heald's lab.
For me, what was truly amazing about this and these spindles is that these cytoplasmic factors that built them are compatible with one another, meaning you can mix the two extracts together at different ratios and get spindles that are proportional resulting size. I started out just really being interested in the question of what sets spindle size. But as I kept going, I started to see larger differences in structure and assembly that made me more curious about kind of how all the parts fit together and how they're arranged in order to affect spindle size.
There are multiple hypotheses regarding how spindle organization is achieved. For example, the search and capture hypothesis states that microtubules emanating from the spindle poles extend toward the center of the oblong spindle apparatus until they contact and form a stable connection with a chromosome.
What we found previously is that there's actually a larger contributing spindle assembly pathway, particularly in Xenopus and egg extracts, and this is mediated by the small GTPase RAN. And RAN, because it's a GTPase, it hydrolyzes GTP, and when it gets in proximity of a chromosome, the chromosome has on it a factor which helps exchange the nucleotide in RAN. So right near the chromosomes, RAN gets loaded with GTP.
GTP-loaded RAN catalyzes the release and activation of microtubule nucleating proteins near the chromosomes. The newly grown microtubules there are then organized into a tiled antiparallel array by a molecular motor, the kinesin 5, egg 5. Therefore, loss of either RAN or egg 5 collapses the spindles in Xenopus laevis egg extracts.
Interestingly, though, the small Xenopus tropicalis spindles are almost completely resistant to disrupting either of these pathways. So if we knock out the RAN GTP pathway or knock out kinesin 5 activity, the spindles are completely fine. They don't even notice. We did not expect this at all.
Why the difference? Helmke and Heald noticed that both Xenopus laevis and tropicalis express a microtubule-associated protein called TPX2, which can bind to egg 5. But TPX2 is expressed at much higher levels in tropicalis than in laevis, and in tropicalis, TPX2 concentrates more strongly at the spindle poles. Helmke saw that depleting TPX2 from tropicalis extracts rendered them sensitive to loss of RAN or egg 5 activity. On the other hand, expression of excess TPX2 in laevis spindles made them more resistant to inhibition of RAN or egg 5. And that's not all.
Adding TPX2 to the laevis spindles affects the density of microtubules in the spindle, and then also where the kinesin 5 motor egg 5 is located in the spindle. So just by adding more TPX2, we saw that microtubules in egg 5 head to the spindle poles.
The clustering of TPX2, egg 5, and microtubules at the spindle poles produces spindles with very few microtubules overlapping in their middles and affects shrinking them. So, overexpressing TPX2 caused Xenopus laevis spindles to more closely resemble those of the smaller tropicalis. Sequence comparison of tropicalis and laevis TPX2 orthologs show that the proteins differed in more ways than just their expression level. For example, tropicalis TPX2 contains a region lacking in laevis TPX2, and mutation studies show that this region causes microtubule nucleation. Weird things happen when tropicalis TPX2 was added to laevis spindles.
Not only Was there a lot more ectopic nucleation with these Xenopus tropicalis TPX2 ortholog? But this also caused the growth of astral microtubule arrays. And these aren't typically seen in meiotic egg extracts, so it was kind of a curveball. And it's been really hard traditionally to study the effect of microtubule nucleation in spindle size and structure. But at least as far as TPX2 is concerned, boosting its activity doesn't seem to affect pole-to-pole spindle length.
Helmke and Heald suspect that relatively high levels of microtubule severing activity in Tropicalis spindles may compensate for microtubule nucleation by Tropicalis TPX2. Interestingly, though, TPX2 orthologs from other, more distantly related organisms lack some of the important functional domains found in the Xenopus versions.
The C. elegans TPX-like protein appears to actually increase spindle length in some studies, which is in contrast to my work, but it's actually a very different protein. It's much truncated compared to the Xenopus version, and according to the current sequence alignments that we have, it doesn't seem to bind to the same kinesin 5, egg 5 motor that the Xenopus version does. And in Drosophila, the ortholog that we know about doesn't even contain either the major interaction domains that have been characterized for this protein, and ultimately it's dispensable for cell division.
And this suggests that TPX2 may have different roles in these animals. Nonetheless, this work points to an important emerging concept in spindle architecture.
Large spindles required for separating chromosomes, you know, over relatively large distances in eggs and early embryos and, you know, in other organisms. These depend on microtubule generation at the spindle midzone through RANGGTP, microtubule nucleation, and organization by egg 5. And in Xenopus, at least, the assembly of a smaller spindle, which spans a shorter distance, appears to be directed more by centrosomes and centrosomal microtubules.
This work also raises several new questions, including what structural features allow Tropicalis TPX2 to nucleate microtubules? And how does interaction between Xenopus TPX2 and Egg 5 affect Egg 5 activity? The Heald Lab is now working on these and other questions, but for now, you can read more about how Xenopus TPX2 affects spindle architecture in the paper by Helmke and Heald, which you can find in the August 4th, 2014 issue of the Journal of Cell Biology.
Thanks, Caitlin. And now here's a roundup of some other highlights from recent issues of the JCB. In our August 4th edition, Wang et al. Reveal how stationary phase yeast cells break down the lipids stored in lipid droplets. The authors propose that yeast deliver lipid droplets to the vacuole via a microautophagy pathway, and then use some of the sterols liberated by the droplet's degradation to form liquid-ordered domains in the vacuole membrane that facilitate the absorption and digestion of additional lipid droplets. Deakin and Turner demonstrate that the focal adhesion protein paxillin inhibits the microtubule deacetylase HDAC6 to promote microtubule stabilization and cell migration. The pathway also helps relocate the Golgi apparatus toward the front of migrating cells. And Werner et al. Describe how the microtubule stabilizing protein clamp and the polarity complex formed by PAR3, PAR6 and atypical PKC promote the radial intercalation of Xenopus epidermal cells. The researchers show that clamp and the PAR complex stabilize microtubules at the leading edge of cells migrating from the interior of frog embryos so that they can integrate into the outermost epithelial layer. Meanwhile, in our August 18th issue, Cheropanova et al. Describe how an oxidoreductase enzyme promotes the glycosylation of newly synthesized proteins in the ER. MAGT1, which contains a thioredoxin-like catalytic domain and is mutated in patients with X-linked mental retardation, associates with an oligosaccharyl transferase complex to facilitate access to N-glycosylation acceptor sites that would otherwise be obscured by the formation of disulfide bonds during protein folding. Piccolo et al. Reveal why sea urchin sperm are able to detect and respond to single molecules of chemoattractant as they navigate toward the egg. The researchers find that 300,000 copies of the guanylyl cyclase chemoreceptor are densely packed into the sperm flagellum. These chemoreceptors bind to the chemoattractant with extremely high affinity. but the sperm dial down their sensitivity when they experience higher chemoattractant concentrations nearer the egg. And Fernandez and Schoch reveal that LASP, a much shorter version of the vertebrate giant protein nebulin, regulates the architecture of Drosophila muscle sarcomeres. Nebulin contains 185 actin-binding repeats and helps to regulate the length of muscle-thin filaments. LASP performs a similar function in flies, despite the fact that it only contains two repeats, each of which appears to have a slightly different function in the maintenance of sarcomeric structure. And in this month's Biocytes video podcast, Claudia Vasquez and Adam Martin describe how Rho kinase and myosin phosphatase dynamically regulate pulsatile myosin contractions to promote the stepwise apical constriction of epithelial cells during Drosophila embryogenesis. You can find out more on all these stories and others by heading to the Journal of Cell Biology's homepage at www.jcb.org. Finally for this podcast, we take a look at how cells regulate the size of their nuclei. Like other organelles, the size of the nucleus varies in different cell types, as Daniel Levy from the University of Wyoming in Laramie explains.
Cell sizes differ really dramatically when you look in different species, compare different cell types during development, and it's been known that there's a correlation between the size of the cell and the size of its internal structures. Going back to studies from, you know, the late 1800s, larger cells tend to have larger organelles, smaller cells, smaller organelles. But really, the underlying mechanisms are only recently beginning to be studied. And for me, it's just a really fascinating basic cell biology question to address.
Levy is particularly interested in the control of nuclear size during Xenopus embryonic development.
So you start off with this gigantic single cell that's over a millimeter in diameter, and it goes through a series of 12 rapid cell divisions to generate an embryo that consists of a few thousand cells that are on the order of 50 microns. And that marks a really important developmental transition called the mid-blastula transition. And at this point in development, cell divisions slow down and major zygotic transcription gets turned on. And then after the MBT, there's further reductions in cell size. And it turns out that these changes in cell size during development are accompanied by reductions in nuclear size. And some of the most really dramatic changes in nuclear size occur around the MBT and beyond. And so it sets up a really nice system to ask what's changing during embryogenesis to regulate the size of the nucleus.
Levy and his graduate student, Lisa Edens, developed an in vitro assay to address this question.
We can make nice big nuclei using the Xenopus egg extract and isolate these large nuclei and then resuspend them in late embryo extracts from these post-MBT embryos. And when we did this, these large nuclei became smaller. And so that really suggested to us that there was some activity present in these late embryo extracts that might be responsible for regulating and reducing nuclear size. We had some suggestions that a kinase might be involved. And so a very talented graduate student who did most of this work, Lisa Edens, decided to look at a panel of kinase inhibitors. And the only inhibitor she was able to identify that could block the shrinking activity was an inhibitor against protein kinase C.
In subsequent experiments, Edens found that nuclear shrinkage was promoted by members of the conventional or classical subfamily of protein kinase C enzymes. The researchers then investigated how these kinases might regulate nuclear size.
We sort of reasoned that there may be changes in components of the nuclear envelope, and so we focused on the nuclear pore complexes and the nuclear lamins, and we found that during this shrinking process, the nuclear pore complexes are not removed, whereas the lamins are. And so changes in lamin association with the nuclear envelope may be mediating this change in nuclear size. We still don't know if the lamins are the direct targets of PKC activity, although there certainly is lots of evidence in other systems that lamins are directly phosphorylated by PKCs. We still don't know if that's the case in our assay, and that's some of the future work we're working on now, is trying to identify what those PKC substrates are. Are they the lamins, and if they're modulating lamina dynamics?
However PKC induces nuclear shrinkage, Edens and Levy wanted to determine whether the kinase also controls nuclear size in vivo.
So we wanted to see if something was changing about PKC during development, and we first looked at total levels of the protein, and sort of initially disappointingly found that the levels of PKC remain constant over the course of development where we're looking. But we did know that PKC activity is frequently regulated by membrane localization. So we wondered if maybe its nuclear localization was changing. And there we found a really dramatic effect where in the early embryo and in nuclei assembled in egg extract, they show very little nuclear PKC localization. Whereas in the post-MBT embryo, as well as in nuclei that were subjected to our shrinking assay, we saw a dramatic increase in nuclear PKC localization. And this correlated with an increase in PKC activity in the post-MBT embryo. So that was all sort of consistent with this idea that changes in PKC localization and activity might be mediating reductions in nuclear size during development.
To test this idea, Edens and Levy manipulated PKC activity in developing embryos.
And we did this in a variety of different ways. I think the way that was maybe the most convincing were experiments where Lisa looked at nuclear dynamics in live Xenopus embryos by confocal microscopy. And what she was able to show was that if she acutely treated embryos with an inhibitor of PKC, she could watch nuclei grow in embryos over the course of a 30 to 45 minute time course. And conversely, if she activated PKC with a small molecule, she could watch nuclei shrink over the same time period. So that really suggested to us that PKC activity within interphase is important for regulating the size of the nucleus in vivo.
Levy says that this PKC-dependent shrinkage is counterbalanced by nuclear growth.
In the early embryo, nuclei really just undergo continual growth. And part of the reason for that is that the cell divisions are so rapid, so interphase is only like 15 minutes. But you can actually even arrest pre-MBT embryos in interphase, and the nuclei just keep growing. And this is a nuclear import-dependent process. And so our model then is that in the post-MBT embryo, this PKC-dependent activity gets turned on, and we think that this shrinking activity that balances growth can explain both why the nuclei are smaller in the post-MBT embryo and also why nuclei now reach a steady state size at the MBT and beyond.
As well as investigating how PKC promotes nuclear shrinkage, Edens and Levy want to discover how the kinases' nuclear localization and activity are regulated during development.
And then the other sort of big question is this activity that we've identified in Xenopus relevant to the regulation of nuclear size in mammalian cells? And ultimately, we're hoping to use sort of all of this information to address what the functional significance of nuclear size is. So it's known that both nuclear size and PKC signaling are altered in cancer cells. And so the possibility that there could be an interesting link there is something we'd like to follow up on. And then ultimately, you know, using this mechanistic information to manipulate nuclear size and then ask if that could in some way contribute to the development or progression of cancer.
In the meantime, however, you can learn more about how conventional protein kinase C regulates nuclear size during Xenopus development in the paper by Lisa Edens and Daniel Levy, published in the August 18, 2014 issue of the Journal of Cell Biology. Well, that wraps things up for this edition of BioBytes. Don't forget you can write to us by emailing biobytes@rockefeller.edu or leave us feedback on our Facebook page at facebook.com/jcellbile. You can become a fan of the JCB and get all the latest updates from the journal. Until next time, goodbye from all of us at the Journal of Cell Biology and good luck with those experiments. Thanks for listening.